Do you have a favorite movie monologue? You know, that moment when a character gives a perfectly crafted speech. Gregory Peck's closing argument in To Kill a Mockingbird. Meryl Streep's lumpy blue sweater lecture in The Devil Wears Prada. Al Pacino's praise of a young man in Scent of a Woman. Samuel L. Jackson's hitman invocation in Pulp Fiction. A monologue can be a turning point in a film, a summation. Some are authentic and effective. Some are corny and hollow. When they work, we remember them. Midday Film critics Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed offer a few of their favorites in the hour ahead. Memorable movie monologues. It's Midday on Film after the news. And welcome to Midday on Film, everybody. A real treat for you this hour. Memorable movie monologues, cinematic soliloquies, when a character in a movie goes on at some length, lecturing, giving a speech, reading a letter, or words from a book, making the closing argument in a trial, pleading for justice or mercy, or telling a story like Robert Shaw's Captain Quint in Jaws telling of the USS Indianapolis. Remember that? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about? Today, a feast for those who love those moments in movies, the ones we remember for years. Joining me once again are Midday film critics Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed. Linda D. is Director of Film and Media Studies at the Johns Hopkins University, and Christopher Llewellyn Reed is Chair and Professor in the Department of Film and Video at the Stevenson University. How do you like my use of the definite article in front of both of your schools? Is that okay?
That's
no.
No, it's not okay. Hopkins dropped the
yes,
definite
article.
The...
I'll check with our PR people.
But I slipped, and I said the Johns Hopkins again today.
I don't know why.
So
they
I thought I would
it.
Call it the Stevenson University.
Just to be fair on both sides.
Yeah. It's time to bring it back.
I like it. Actually, nice to have you both on the show again, and I'm glad we're getting to do this. I love movie monologues. I kind of, they're the ones you remember. Some are good, some are great, some are not so good. The ones that are not so good, we'll dispense with that for a moment. A monologue that doesn't work, what?
Well, you called these cinematic soliloquies,
yeah,
which is linking these back to the grand theatrical tradition of an actor turning to himself or to the audience to basically express inner thoughts,
right,
because there's no other way on stage for us to hear the voice that we would normally hear only in our heads. And so that's sort of how these came about. I think the ones that do not work feel too much like pure exposition, where we are merely hearing that voice in order to explain some things that could just as well be explained visually. Right. And then the ones that work sort of have a better raison d'être,
mm-hmm,
where, you know, it's motivated by something that's going on right then, and it masks the exposition through conversation or a legitimate speech on camera.
And Linda, you know, there can be moments like that too that make you cringe because of they're not well written, they're corny.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I am not a huge monologue lover or seeker. And so I actually had some trouble thinking at first of what I would choose. And I think part of the problem with monologues is that they do stop the show. And they are, in many ways, they can be, and often are in films, anti-cinematic.
Mm-hmm.
Because film is all about showing, not telling. And so for me, the best monologues are the ones that are cinematically bold or interesting, and they do, as Chris was saying, they serve a variety of functions, and they don't stop the show. They don't stop the flow of the images. So, and I think we'll be able to talk a little bit more about that as we go through the examples.
I think our lists, Linda's list, Chris's list, my short list are all what we consider good moments in film. I don't know if we'll all agree, but certainly that's how we feel about them. Okay, so we're not presenting any bad monologues today. I'm going to start by taking a phone call from Jim in Baltimore, who has called in about a monologue that is on the list of both Chris and Linda. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hi there, Dan.
What is your favorite monologue?
And also, I am also from the Johns Hopkins University.
Okay, all right. Thanks for calling, Jim.
My favorite monologue is from a movie that I just absolutely love in many different ways, which is Carol Reed's The Third Man. And it's, of course, Orson Welles as Harry Lyme, his famous cuckoo clock monologue.
Okay, let's listen to it, Jim, and then we can talk about it, all right? But, Chris, why don't you introduce it?
So this is the famous scene following Orson Welles and Joseph Cotten's journey on the Ferris wheel in Vienna and the Prater, where Orson Welles has revealed to Harry Lyme that he's basically selling medicine on the black market, bad medicine that is leading to lots of people's deaths to earn money for purely selfish reasons. And his friend, played by Joseph Cotten, is horrified. And in response to, in Orson Welles' mind, Joseph Cotten's naive horror, Orson Welles' Harry Lyme delivers this speech.
Holly, I'd like to cut you in, old man. There's nobody left in Vienna I can really trust, and we've always done everything together. When you make up your mind, send me a message. I'll meet you any place, any time. And when we do meet, old man, it's you I want to see, not the police. Remember that, won't you? Don't be so gloomy. After all, it's not that awful. What the fella said. In Italy, for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock. So long, Holly.
And there's the famous music, too, from that movie.
The Zithar.
Yeah, yes. Linda.
Oh, God, it's so great. It's great because it's Orson. It's a brilliant speech. And it matches his character and the way we respond to him, because he shows up, well, I'm spoiling here a little bit. He shows up, shall I say, unexpectedly. And everyone is talking about him. He's the center of the film. He is the third man. And he is deeply, profoundly evil. But he's Orson Welles, and we love him. And he gives this wonderful excuse for his moral equivocation. And he dashes it off so charmingly and beautifully and mellifluously that we can't help but be susceptible to his charms as much as we hate to, as well as Holly. He is also susceptible to him.
Memorable movie monologues on Midday on Film. A lot of them occur in courtrooms or something like that. I have one from Scent of a Woman. Al Pacino won the Academy Award for Best Actor for Scent of a Woman. In this movie, he befriends a New England prep school student, played by Chris O'Donnell, who refuses to snitch on classmates who really don't deserve his protection. Chris O'Donnell's character is Charlie Sims. Charlie Sims faces a school disciplinary committee. But Al Pacino, who plays a blind retired Army lieutenant colonel, defends him at this hearing, which is much like a courtroom scene.
As I came in here, I heard those words, cradle of leadership. Well, when the bow breaks, the cradle will fall, and it has fallen here. It has fallen. Makers of men. Creators are leaders. Be careful what kind of leaders you're producing here. I don't know if Charlie's silence here today is right or wrong. I'm not a judge or jury, but I can tell you this. He won't sell anybody out to buy his future. And that, my friends, is called integrity. That's called courage. Now, that's the stuff leaders should be made of. Now, I have come to the crossroads in my life. I always knew what the right path was. Without exception, I knew. But I never took it. You know why? It was too damn hard. Now here's Charlie. He's come to the crossroads. He has chosen a path. It's the right path. It's a path made of principle that leads to character. Let him continue on his journey. You hold this boy's future in your hands, committee. It's a valuable future. Believe me. Don't destroy it. Protect it. Embrace it. It's going to make you proud one day, I promise you.
Al Pacino in Scent of a Woman. That's from my short list of favorite monologues. It's longer than that, but that's just a great scene. And he won the Academy Award.
I think you're so right to point out how so many of these kinds of monologues happen in courtrooms. I mean, just thinking of some of the obvious ones, To Kill a Mockingbird, A Few Good Men, even My Cousin Vinny.
That's right. That's right.
Because such, and it actually in Scent of a Woman, it's not specifically a courtroom. What is it again? It's a school.
It's a disciplinary
hearing.
In front of the whole student
body. That's right.
Body.
It's the same kind of thing, because there you have a motivation for the speech. And whether one ends up liking the monologue or not, it is the perfect setting to place a well-written or crafted speech that feels like a speech.
Linda, we'll go to your list next. Al Pacino was in this movie, The Godfather. And this is an unusual monologue because it actually opens the film, right?
Yes, it does. Very first words. In fact, the film begins in blackness, and we hear the first line of this monologue in blackness, and then we cut to the close-up of a face of a man who is not a familiar actor, happens to be Buonasera, the undertaker. Well, we don't know this when we first see the film, and this is what I'm talking about with a monologue that is both cinematic and a great piece of work that amplifies the meaning of the film. We start on a very close, tight shot of this guy's face, and we have a very slow zoom out as he's speaking.
I believe in America. America has made my fortune, and I raised my daughter in the American fashion. I gave her freedom, but I taught her never to dishonor her family. She found a boyfriend, not an Italian. She went to the movies with him. She stayed out late. I didn't protest. 2 months ago, he took her for a drive with another boyfriend. They made her drink whiskey. And then they tried to take advantage of her. She resisted. She kept her honor. So they beat her like an animal.
And then
this is also a much longer monologue. It goes on for some time, and then what happens is, as the camera tracks back, we finally land in the foreground on a man that we will soon recognize as a remarkably transformed Marlon Brando, who is the Godfather. And then we find out that Buonasera has been delivering this monologue to the Godfather to ask a favor of him. It's brilliant.
And Linda and Chris, he throws America back at Buonasera. He says, you came to America, this is the American dream, that you believed in the system, you believed in the police would protect you and the courts would protect you.
Right.
And you never came to me for help.
And it's interesting, of course, I believe in America is really what the entire film is about, the whole saga, what the American dream is, how it comes to be the province of these particular kinds of people. But what's also interesting to me is that it introduces this theme of protection. So much of what these men do is done in the name of protecting women. And throughout the film, both films, we will see women over and over again raped, abused, violently used in many different ways by a variety of good and bad men. And it is always what they do. Their evil deeds are always done in the name of, we're protecting women and children. We're protecting our families.
So it's a monologue that, as we were saying earlier, serves multiple purposes, and that's what makes it so strong.
Let's take a call from one of our listeners here. We invited calls, so as we go along, we'll hear from you, too, for your favorite movie scenes, memorable movies. Jeff in Lutherville, he's referring to a film called Saturday Night, Sunday Morning.
Yeah, I have I don't know why I have a mental block against the actor's name. I mean, I've
That's
loved his
Albert
work.
Finney. But
Albert Finney?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. Oh, no, Albert Finney, but every morning he says, it's all propaganda, if I'm quoting it verbatim, it's all propaganda, I'm just out for a bit of fun. So I just wonder what you think.
Is Linda familiar with that one? Jeff, let me ask Linda about it. Saturday Night, Sunday Morning.
Yes, I believe it was made in 1959. It's grew out of the kitchen sink tradition in British 50s drama, neorealist about working class people. Hmm. Albert Finney plays a young working class man in a northern industrial town in England. And, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I love the film. And it's a brilliant piece of acting, and it's really about sticking it to the man.
Hmm. Okay, well, thank you for mentioning it. It's a title I wasn't familiar with.
Yeah, it's a great film.
Thank you, Jeff. Before we go to our first break, let's go to Chris Reed's list of movie monologues. I'll let you introduce this one. This is a pretty famous one.
Yes, it is. I probably don't have to do too much plot summary, but this is Casablanca. It's from the famous airport scene at the end of the film when Humphrey Bogart, Rick, is convincing or trying to convince Ilsa, Ingrid Bergman, that she needs to leave without him and with her husband, Victor Laszlo. It's a monologue that gets occasionally interrupted by the person to whom the monologue is addressed, in this case, Ilsa. It's a brilliant script overall, written by multiple writers, the Epstein twins, Philip and Julius, and Howard Koch. But yet, out of this kind of collaboration comes amazing scenes like this.
Inside of us, we both know you belong with Victor. You're part of his work, the thing that keeps him going. If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life.
But what about us?
We'll always have Paris. We didn't have, we lost it until you came to Casablanca. We got it back last night.
When I said I would never leave you.
And you never will. But I've got a job to do too. Where I'm going, you can't follow. What I've got to do, you can't be any part of. Ilsa, I'm no good at being noble, but it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Someday you'll understand that. No. He's looking at you, kid.
Memorable movie monologues on Midday on Film with Chris Reed and Linda DeLibero. Dan Roderick's here. A short break, and you're welcome to join us, too, if there's one you want to mention. 410-662-8780. Welcome back. Midday on Film, a look at and a listen to memorable movie monologues. Let's see. Dan tweeted in, Alec Baldwin in Glengarry Glen Ross, practically a mantra in the sales world. Now, this is very interesting. Very at the very beginning of this film, which is about real estate salesmen who aren't doing so well. They need a serious pep talk, and they get a profane one, a real in-your-face pep talk from Alec Baldwin, who shows up from the he's a consultant who makes a lot of money, and he shows up from the main office and tells Ed Harris and Alan Arkin and Jack Lemmon, and there's somebody else sitting there too. Who am I loving now? Pacino's in this film, but he is not in that scene. Anyway, he's telling them they got to get on the ball, or you know, all is lost for them. They won't have a job. So here's a little bit of it. It's much longer and much more profane that you'll hear here, but this gives you a sense of it.
A, B, C. A, always, B, B, C, closing. Always be closing. Always be closing. A, I, D, A. Attention, interest, decision, action. Attention. Do I have your attention? Interest. Are you interested? I know you are, because it's or walk. You close or you hit the bricks. Decision. Have you made your decision for Christ? An action. AIDA. Get out there. You got the prospects coming in. You think they came in to get out of the rain? A guy don't walk on the lot lest he wants to buy. They're sitting out there waiting to give you their money. Are you going to take it? Are you man enough to take it?
Oh, my God. And it's thundering lightning, it's heavy rainstorm. I didn't mention Kevin Spacey. He's also in that scene. He's the office manager of this real estate company.
And there's another monologue that is motivated very much by the scene. David Mamet wrote the play and the screenplay. And, you know, there's a reason whether one likes the movie or not, and I think it's a fine film. But there's a reason for Alec Baldwin to be doing what he's doing at that moment. So it feels less like an expositional speech than the monologues that don't work. It's right on the money for that.
Thank you, Chris. Christopher Llewellyn Reed and Linda DeLibro here for Midday on Film. A look at memorable movie monologues. We'll take another call before we go back to Linda's list. Robert in Towson, one that you want to mention to us. Go right ahead, Robert.
Well, this might be a little obscure. I see you're doing really good movies. I think this is a good movie. It's Snatch. I think Guy Ritchie was the director. But there's a gentleman in the movie named Bricktop. And when he catches some he's a criminal himself. And when he catches some inept criminals, he asks them, the beginning of the monologue starts, do you know the meaning of the word nemesis? And then he goes on to explain the meaning of the word nemesis. There's probably some words in there you can't say on the radio.
Okay. Robert,
it's really funny.
That's Snatch, S-N-A-T-C-H, and that's Brad Pitt in this,
yeah,
right?
That's Guy Ritchie.
Yeah, it's a Guy Ritchie film. Okay. Yeah, one of those British gangster films.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have to go back and – I think I saw that. I have to go back and check for monologue.
It's fun.
Bob in Baltimore wrote in to say, my all-time favorite movie monologue would be Clark Griswold, Chevy Chase, his rant to the assembled family after receiving a membership in the Jelly of the Month Club as his Christmas bonus in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. So, all right, whatever turns you on. Michael Douglas in The American President, 1995. Linda in Stewartstown, Pennsylvania says, I saw it last week. He left us both breathless.
I have to say, I'm a sucker for that film. I love Douglas and Annette Bening together in the film. And there at the end, his speech is very much motivated, even though it has some of the Aaron Sorkin tendencies to sound very speechified. He's addressing the members of the press after a major crisis, and everything that comes out of his mouth has purpose. And I love that ending speech. Mm.
John's email on this says, my new favorite monologue is the You Don't Matter monologue delivered by Emma Stone to her father, Michael Keaton, in Birdman, when we just listened to that clip, I think, last week?
A couple weeks ago, we played that, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and you got to see her face, too. I mean, obviously, you got to see this is radio, but the facial expression of the daughter when she finishes that rant against her dad. Wow. And then John also says, an old favorite is the Sonny monologue by Morgan Freeman in Shawshank Redemption when he goes up for parole and he refers to the chairman of the parole board as Sonny. That's a really great scene. I kind of wish we had that today, but we have so many to get to. We're going to move back to Linda's list right now. Linda, you have, On the Waterfront.
Yes, it's a dialogue that turns into a monologue, and it's probably the most famous exchange in movie history, along with the one we just played from Casablanca. And it's so renowned in part because this moment between these two brothers, Charlie and our star, Marlon Brando, who is a boxer, has always been the dumb one. And he has come to a moral recognition of his cupidity, and he's done something wrong. And his brother Charlie, who's the smart one, the gangster, the successful one, has always been in charge. And it's Terry has always gone along with him. And at this moment in the taxi cab, he realizes that it's been his brother all along who's betrayed him, and he comes to this recognition right there.
Remember that night in the garden, you came down my dressing room and said, kid, this ain't your night. We're going for the price on Wilson. You remember that? This ain't your night. My night, I could have taken Wilson apart. So what happens? He gets the title shot outdoors in a ballpark, and what do I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short-end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it.
This scene always makes me sad. I'm sad right now just listening to it.
It's powerful stuff. The script is written by Bud Schulberg. The movie was, of course, directed by Elia Kazan. It's powerful stuff. The first time I saw the film, it moved me, too. And it's a great performance.
It's interesting because Rod Steiger plays Charlie. Of course, Brando plays Terry. And Steiger, in the two shots, Brando is there. But in the single shots, Brando had to go see his psychiatrist, and Rod Steiger was very, very upset that he had to play to an absent actor, and he never forgave him for that for the rest of his
life. That's a great story. Thank you, Linda. Chris, I want to listen to a famous monologue or soliloquy, Peter Finch in Network in 1976, and Greg in Baltimore is calling in about that, but let's listen to the Peter Finch monologue first. Just set it up a little bit for us.
So Peter Finch plays a network anchor who's had a breakdown, and he's found out that they're firing him, and that precipitates the breakdown. And the network decides that since he had his first breakdown unexpectedly on camera, that the audience responded surprisingly positively to it, that they're going to decide to back him and give him his own show as the movie goes on, and he becomes a sort of prophet of discontent,
right,
in the movie. And there are a few different monologues that he speaks in the film. I'm not sure specifically which one this one is, but I'm sure it's going to include the famous line, "I'm mad as hell."
I think that's where we're headed. So let's listen in.
We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressmen because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window. Open it and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore.
My God, it's King Lear, isn't it? So Greg in Baltimore wanted to call in about this and tell us something about Network. Go right ahead, Greg. Welcome to the show. Greg? Oh, tell me Greg is gone after that big buildup. I wanted to say this. Maybe Greg is the same person who posted on my Facebook page regarding Ned Beatty and Network. Ned Beatty has his own monologue.
Yes, Ned Beatty's sort of the Uber boss, the head of the network, who ends up he has his own agenda for using the film's about sort of competing corporate agendas, and Ned Beatty ends up sort of delivering his own speech to the Peter Finch character to motivate him to do what he, Ned Beatty, wants him to do.
Greg, if it's the same Greg, I believe it is, he says, I've been teaching Paddy Chayefsky's Network in my media class at Morgan State for years. That film is known for two great Howard Beale monologues, The Mad as Hell, the one we just heard, also Turn Off Your TVs, but the great monologue by Ned Beatty's character, Arthur Jensen, should not be forgotten. And Greg, thank you very much. He posted it on my Facebook page if anyone wants to go there and get a listen to it. Now, I'm going to throw in another courtroom scene. Colonel Nathan Jessup, played by Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men, because this one of these scenes, I just find it irresistible. If this happens to be on television and I'm clicking through and there's A Few Good Men and Tom Cruise and this particular scene, I just stop and I listen. Colonel Jessup, a Marine colonel, being confronted, a famous standoff between him and the Navy lawyer played by Tom Cruise in A Few Good Men.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's gonna do it? You? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know, that Santiago's death, while tragic, probably saved lives. And my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way. Otherwise, I suggest you pick up a weapon and stand a post. Either way, I don't give a damn what you think you are entitled to.
And then it's, did you order the code red? I'm sorry.
Go ahead. That's an Aaron Sorkin pen script for a Rob Reiner film. And, you know, Sorkin also wrote The American President and West Wing and The Social Network. And he's known for having these kinds of moments in his films where the particular character delivers this speech expressing exactly how they feel. That's why people are drawn to Aaron Sorkin movies.
Chris Reed, we'll go to you. Back to your list. This is a Sidney Poitier film.
Yes, this is Guess Who's Coming to Dinner from a director, Stanley Kramer, who could be kind of heavy-handed with his moral indignation. Much of the films that he did as a director took on really worthy causes, but sometimes with a little bit of a heavy hand, as I said. But this is a great moment in the film, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, from a script by William Rose, where Sidney Poitier, the African-American super doctor who's proposed marriage to the white daughter of this well-to-do Los Angeles couple, is speaking to his own father, who's arrived because neither set of parents is happy with the upcoming nuptials. And here he's confronting his own father for his father trying to tell him that he, Sidney Poitier, owes the older generation something. He's turning it around and saying, no, you owe me.
Let me tell you something. I owe you nothing. If you carried that bag a million miles, you did what you were supposed to do because you brought me into this world. And from that day, you owed me everything you could ever do for me, like I will owe my son if I ever have another. But you don't own me. You can't tell me when or where I'm out of line or try to get me to live my life according to your rules. You don't even know what I am, Dad. You don't know who I am. You don't know how I feel, what I think. And if I try to explain it the rest of your life, you will never understand. You are 30 years older than I am. You and your whole lousy generation believes the way it was for you is the way it's got to be. And not until your whole generation has lain down and died will the dead weight of you be off our backs.
It's a great performance by Sidney Poitier, you know, who actually rarely, if ever, gave a bad performance. But mm-hmm. I think he really makes that scene his own. And, you know, later on in the film, there are other speeches. But I think this is one of the best moments in the movie.
We're going to take another break here. But before we do, a couple more calls from our listeners of Midday on Film. Dan in Woodstock, Maryland. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Loving your show today.
Thank you.
Recently got to talking about a favorite of mine on Facebook, Five Easy Pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you just did a Jack Nicholson from from the courtroom scene, you know, you can't handle the truth, which I use in my own daily conversation quite frequently. But the one that sold me on Jack Nicholson that, you know, it was an earlier movie and made me love him as an actor was Five Easy Pieces. Now, if you remember the scene, he's driving on a highway with a couple other people, and they make a stop at the diner. And he wants to get the breakfast with an omelet and a side order of toast, meets up with a waitress who explains to him there's no substitute and she can't make any changes, and they get into a rather sharp dialogue, and Jack explains to her how she can do it, you know, you make, you have a toaster, right? You have, you make sandwiches. Now here's what you do: you make a chicken sandwich, and you hold the, you hold all those things on it—the lettuce, the tomato, and the mayonnaise, and the rest. And she says to him, "What do you want me to do with the chicken?"
Okay, all right, Dan.
You remember that one?
Yeah, sure, we remember that.
You want me to hold the chicken? Yeah. I want you to hold it between your legs.
Stop. It's not a monologue. I mean, it's a great, it's a memorable scene. It's dialogue.
Right,
and
an exchange.
It's an exchange, but it's not quite monologue. But anyway, thank you for that memory. It is a great scene. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. We'll take a break, come back, and listen to some more memorable movie monologues. Monologues here with Linda and Chris. It's Midday on Film. Dan Roderick's with Christopher Llewellyn Reed and Linda DeLibro. Great movie monologues, those moments that won the day, turned the tide, and made a film memorable. Let's take another call. Tom in Mount Vernon. Thanks for holding. What did you want to offer, Tom?
Yes, my favorite film, Dan, is A Man for All Seasons. It starred Paul Scofield as Sir Thomas More.
Right.
The movie is filled with terrific. Everything is good in that movie. The very end of it, in the courtroom scene, the climax, where Sir Thomas More has to defend himself for criticizing King Henry VIII for taking over the church and also for a divorce.
Right.
And I was in a and stationed in the Navy in 1967, and I was at a theater with 1,000 other sailors. And when that scene was completed, I'd never seen anything like it. There was a standing ovation. All those guys stood up and cheered because they were so moved by that scene.
Thank you, Tom. I saw that film a couple of years ago again, and it holds up pretty well. It's really a powerful movie.
Yeah, and it is adapted from a stage play, much like a movie of that we have a clip from that's very similar to it, released the year after The Lion in Winter, which is about Eleanor of Aquitaine and her sons and Henry, her husband. And in this scene, we have Katharine Hepburn lecturing her sons, Richard, known as Richard the Lionhearted, played by Anthony Hopkins, and John, and Gregory, I think, is the name of the third son, basically about how horrible their family dynamic is and how the reason they're always fighting is because they basically are incapable of being otherwise.
Their
nature
of
the family, the nature of their family is to have these internecine squabbles, and she delivers what I consider a very fine monologue.
Let it go for now.
I can't.
Not so hard. Try saying after me. John wins, I lose.
And what if John died?
No, why wasn't there? Why wasn't there?
A knife! He's got a knife!
Of course he has a knife. He always has a knife. We all have knives. It's 1183 and we're barbarians. How clear we make it. Oh, my piglets, we are the origins of war. Not history's forces, nor the times, nor justice, nor the lack of it, nor causes, nor religions, nor ideas, nor kinds of government, nor any other thing. We are the killers. We breed wars. We carry it like syphilis inside. Dead bodies rot in field and stream because the living ones are rotten. For the love of God, can't we love one another just a little? That's how peace begins. We have so much to love each other for. We have such possibilities, my children.
I love that. By 1183, we should all be so civilized. Wonderful. Thank you for that, Chris. Linda, we'll go back to your list of memorable monologues. This is at the end of The Last Picture Show. Cloris Leachman.
Yes, Cloris Leachman plays the wife of the high school basketball coach, whose husband has long since stopped paying attention to her at all. So early in the film, she has an affair with one of his students, who's played by Timothy Bottoms, Sonny, and it revives her. She comes alive. She has something to live for. And then Sonny falls in love with JC, the town beauty queen, played by Sybil Shepherd, and deserts her. And then these terrible things happen, and he comes crawling back. And, of course, she lets him in to the background sounds of a ridiculous TV show. And she's trembling as she serves him coffee and then finally lets loose with this.
What am I doing apologizing to you? Why am I always apologizing to you, you little bastard? 3 months I've been apologizing to you without you even being here. I haven't done anything wrong. Why can't I quit apologizing? You're the one ought to be sorry. I wouldn't still be in my bathrobe if it hadn't been for you. I'd had my clothes on hours ago. You're the one made me quit caring if I got dressed or not. I guess just because your friend got killed, you want me to forget what you did and make it all right? I'm not sorry for you. You'd have left Billy, too, just like you left me. I bet you left him plenty of nights. Whenever J.C. whistled, I wouldn't treat a dog that way. I guess you thought I was so old and ugly, you didn't owe me any explanation. You didn't need to be careful of me. There wasn't anything I could do about you and her. Why should you be careful of me? You didn't love me. Look at me. Didn't you even look at me?
It's Ryan O'Neill, right?
No.
It's Timothy Bottoms?
Yes,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
And Jeff Bridges is in the film.
Jeff Bridges
is his friend. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. You said Timothy Bottoms.
Yeah.
Okay. Linda had another one. This is Elizabeth Taylor in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf with Richard Burton, but a scene just Elizabeth Taylor speaking.
Yes, and this is a Mike Nichols' adaptation of the Edward Albee play, and a really fine adaptation it was, done in black and white, very stark. Doesn't try to tone down the language or the nasty emotions, but this is Elizabeth Taylor, I think, in one of her absolute best performances, as she is talking about her husband, George. She is Martha. They have a very contentious relationship. If anybody knows anything about the play, would know that. And here she's talking about her very equivocal feelings about him.
George, who was out somewhere there in the dark, who is good to me, whom I revile, who can keep learning the games we play as quickly as I can change them, who can make me happy, and I do not wish to be happy. Yes, I do wish to be happy. George and Martha. Sad, sad, sad. Whom I will not forgive for having come to rest, for having seen me and having said, yes, this will do, who has made the hideous, the hurting, the insulting mistake of loving me. I must be punished for it. George and Martha. Sad, sad.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Thank you for that, Linda. Thank you for your whole list. Chris, Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Yes. So moving forward about 30 years after Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, I chose this clip because this is the moment in the film where the main character played by Hugh Grant has just discovered that the woman that he loves, he just realized he loves more than anything, played by Andy McDowell, is getting married. To a much older man, and he decides that he just has to confess his love to her. But unlike in perhaps another kind of film, his monologue doesn't come out in quite the usually well-crafted, articulate manner that we've come to expect. So this is a monologue that in some sense is taking on this idea of the articulate monologue.
Sorry, sorry. This is a really stupid question, and particularly in view of our recent shopping excursion. But I just wondered if by any chance, obviously not, because I am just some kid who's only slept with 9 people, but I just wondered, I really feel, in short, to recap in a slightly clearer version, in the words of David Cassidy, in fact, while he was still with the Partridge family, I think I love you. And just wondered whether by any chance you wouldn't like to... No, of course not. I'm an idiot. He's not. Excellent, excellent. Fantastic. I'm so sorry. Lovely to see you. Sorry to disturb. Better get on.
Excellent. Excellent choice of that one, Chris. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I'm going to throw in something completely different here to draw our listeners' attention to this movie called The Oxbow Incident, 1943, directed by William Wellman, starring Henry Fonda, Dana Andrews, and Henry Morgan. Harry Morgan? Colonel Potter.
Yeah, Colonel Potter. I think it's Harry Morgan. Yeah.
Harry Morgan. Henry Fonda and Harry Morgan find themselves part of a posse in a Nevada town, a posse that sets out to find three men who killed a rancher and rustled some of his cattle. At the end of the film, members of the posse realize that they've hanged an innocent man, including the character played by Dana Andrews. Henry Fonda reads, they've hanged three men, actually, including Dana Andrews. Henry Fonda reads the letter that the doomed man was allowed to write to his wife hours before his death.
My dear wife, Mr. Davies will tell you what's happening here tonight. He's a good man and has done everything he can for me. I suppose there's some other good men here, too, only they don't seem to realize what they're doing. They're the ones I feel sorry for, because it'll be over for me in a little while, but they'll have to go on remembering for the rest of their lives. Man just naturally can't take the law into his own hands and hang people without hurting everybody in the world, because then he's just not breaking one law, but all laws. Law's a lot more than words you put in a book, or judges or lawyers or sheriffs you hire to carry it out. It's everything people ever have found out about justice and what's right and wrong. It's the very conscience of humanity. There can't be any such thing as civilization unless people have a conscience. Because if people touch God anywhere, where is it except through their conscience? And what is anybody's conscience except a little piece of the conscience of all men that ever lived? I guess that's all I got to say, except kiss the babies for me and God bless you. Your husband, Donald.
And then they step out of the saloon and go out into the street and get on their horses. Harry Morgan and Henry Fonda. And then Harry Morgan says something here. He asks them where they're going, right?
Yeah, it's a very profound moment at the end of a very profound film in many ways. I just taught this film last semester in my film history class. And it's a film that takes on, you know, mob violence, mob justice, with great performance by Dana Andrews as the man who wrote that letter that Henry Fonda's reading. So
He wanted his wife to get this letter, didn't he? So there was nobody looking after the kids, didn't he?
So they both get on their horses.
So they both get on their horses and ride away.
And I noticed the movie ends the way it begins. They're two drifters who ride into town. They ride out of town.
Yeah, the film isn't at all what you expect it's going to be in the beginning of the film. When you have these two characters, as you say, drift in, you don't expect this to be this kind of really, you know, this expose of mob justice. But I think it's a very fine film. It's short, too. It's only like 75 minutes.
Oxbow incident. So there's other monologues that I guess we don't have time for. To Kill a Mockingbird, a famous scene with Atticus Finch, played by Gregory Peck in that. Tootsie made your list. We didn't get to the Tootsie clip, I'm sorry. And even Judy Garland's final speech in No Place Like Home from The Wizard of Oz. We ought to do this again sometime, though. This was fun. I really enjoyed it.
There's also Meryl Streep in Devil Wears Prada.
Oh, yeah.
It was a great one, yeah.
Oh, we didn't get to that.
I highly
either.
Recommend that one if people haven't heard it.
Right. And then Robert Shaw's storytelling in Jaws about the Indianapolis, another example of monologue. Anyway, we could do this again another time. So I thank you very much, Linda DeLibro from Johns Hopkins University.
Thank you, Dan.
The Johns Hopkins University. And Christopher Llewellyn Reed from the Stevenson University. Thank you very much. They both join us once a month on the first Friday of every month for Midday on Film. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Dan.
Have a great weekend, everybody. See you again soon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Marjorie Goodman, Aaron Morenzi, and Mary Troutman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.